Today we have part two of a sea story, Whistling Jack. So if you haven't listened to part one yet, click back over to the podcast's main page and listen to Whistling Jack part one. Arr, mateys! Welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres, and today we have Whistling Jack, Part 2. So if you haven't listened to Part 1, click back over to the podcast main page and listen to Whistling Jack, Part 1. So you'll recall in Whistling Jack, Part 1, this is a story of superstition. And as we know, sailors can be a superstitious bunch. And here we have Whistling Jack, who is an old mysterious sailor. And occasionally, while aboard ship at sea, he begins to whistle. And what the crew has noticed is that this is a precursor to some sort of disaster. When Jack whistles, sure enough, after a very short time, there's a storm, a horrible storm, or some other tragedy befalls the ship and the crew at sea. And as we saw in the first part of this story, Whistling Jack had begun to whistle, and the crew and several of the passengers became a little nervous about this, and sure enough, within 24 hours, the massive hurricane came down on the ship, broke down the masts, and left the ship just a very short distance off the coast of Cuba. The rocks and the breakers were right there, and as the clouds cleared, the crew realized that they were right next to the entrance to the Havana Harbor. So they got the ship into the harbor, and they did the repairs, and now they're back out at sea, and once again, Whistling Jack has whistled, and everyone's nervous about what's going to happen. And you'll recall we've got Captain McGregor, and we have the first mate is Mr. Hammond, who he has already threatened Whistling Jack and told him that he better not whistle anymore. But sure enough, Whistling Jack has whistled, and we're at sea, and we're moving along, and we're waiting. Something bad may happen here. And you'll recall we have two passengers aboard, Mr. Calderon and his daughter, Margaret. And the ship is en route to Belize. And we've just left the Havana Harbor. We've been at sea for a couple of days, and this is where the story picks up. So let's just hear a quick word from our sponsor, and then we'll get on with today's story, Whistling Jack. On the fifth day after leaving Havana, with a light, baffling winds and a strong current rushing through the narrow strait which separates Cuba from Yucatan, we found ourselves some 20 or 30 miles to the northward of Cape Antonio in the Gulf of Mexico. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon when a fine breeze sprang up from the east-southeast, and we crowded all sail on a wind to the southward, with the expectation of soon passing the Cape, already notorious for many piracies which had been committed in this vicinity, and entering into the Caribbean Sea and reaching our wished-for port in the Bay of Honduras. This prospect seemed to cheer the hearts of all on board. Even Whistling Jack, by a sort of diagonal grin, manifested feelings of delight, and Miss Calderon could hardly contain her transports. She clapped her little hands for joy when she saw the noble vessel urged rapidly on her way by a fresh and delightful breeze. She would pass along the deck to the bow and watch with delight the ever-varying ripples constantly forming by the motion of the vessel, or sit on the taffrail and gaze at the lingering wake. Since leaving Havana, we had seen several vessels passing in different directions, which, at a glance, were known as merchantmen engaged in errands connected with commerce. The sight of a stranger on the ocean, when it conjures up no fears of an enemy in war or a pirate in peace, forms a pleasant interruption to the monotony of a sea voyage, and our fair passenger had derived much gratification in gazing on their snow-white sails and graceful movements as, obedient to the controlling power on their decks, they glided noiselessly over the surface of the sea towards their wished-for ports. But during the last day of the calm, no strange vessel was to be seen. The Priam seemed alone on the ocean. On the memorable afternoon on which the breeze sprung up, and while we were rapidly approaching Cape Latouche, intended to keep as far from Cape Antonio as possible, I was ordered aloft by Mr. Hammond to put a new seizing on the Flemish horse at the starboard foretopsail yardarm. After I had completed the job, I took a look around the horizon, and, shipmates, I must confess, a chill crept over me when I saw, about 4 points on the weather bow, a vessel steering in a direction which would soon bring her close aboard. She was a small schooner, sitting low on the water, with raking masts and only 3 fore-and-aft sails. There was nothing in itself alarming or even suspicious in her appearance. Indeed, she resembled a friendly pilot boat, such as are fallen in with off the capes of the Chesapeake or Sandy Hook, and are greeted with cheers of gladness by the tempest-tossed mariners on approaching his native shore after years in absence in distant seas. But the appearance of such a vessel in the Gulf of Mexico carried with it associations of a different character, piracy and murder. And it is probable that the tone of my voice might have betrayed my apprehensions when I shouted, "Sail ho!" I indicated the direction in which the vessel was seen, and described her rig, at which I fancied a cloud passed over the countenance of the captain. He took his spyglass with him to the foreyard and examined the stranger long and narrowly. As we rapidly neared each other, the schooner could be seen from the deck and became an object of scrutiny to every person on board. From the grave countenances around and the serious, speaking looks which were exchanged, it was clear that the strange vessel was not regarded as an object of welcome or delight. Margaret Calderon looked up in her father's face, but saw there nothing to allay her rising suspicions of danger. She turned to Captain MacGregor, but he seemed, watching the motions of the schooner with fixed and eager gaze, as if he was determined to penetrate the veil which concealed the character of the vessel. "Captain MacGregor," said Margaret earnestly, laying her hand on his shoulder, "do tell me what you think of that vessel. Is there cause for alarm? Do you think it is a pirate?" MacGregor turned round and with a forced smile and a gentle voice replied, "I will not conceal from you, Miss Calderon, that the general appearance of that vessel in these seas and the course which she is steering, combined with the many rumors which were in circulation in Havana when we left that port, furnish some cause for suspicion that all about her is not exactly as it should be. Nevertheless, our suspicions may be unjust, and the schooner may be engaged in some honest commercial undertaking." "Perhaps," said Mr. Calderon to his daughter, "she is a Yankee schooner returning to New Orleans after supplying the Cubanos with a cargo of notions." "Or," said MacGregor, "perhaps she is running down to Sicily, the bearer of important intelligence from some American house in Havana." Whistling Jack, who, with the others of the crew, had been silently listening to the conversation, shook his head and muttered, as if in soliloquy, "I wish it might prove so, but," and he gave Margaret a look which expressed a volume of mournful meaning. The color forsook her cheeks, and from that moment she sought to prepare herself for the worst which might happen. "At all events," said Captain MacGregor, with a marked change in his tone and manner, "I will soon ascertain his true character. Ready about," and while the men were mustering to their stations, he conducted Margaret to the quarterdeck. The pale girl refused to go below, but stood in the companionway while the evolution was carried into effect. The captain gave the necessary orders with his usual decided and manly tone, and the brig was soon on the other tack, steering to the northeastward, while the course the schooner was pursuing was nearly west-northwest. Her distance at this moment was about 6 miles in a southeast direction, and now every eye was directed towards the schooner, while intense anxiety was witnessed in the countenance of every man on board. At length, Mr. Hammond broke the silence by a boisterous, "Ha, ha, ha! I knew there was no cause for alarm. That fellow is about his regular business, and if we let him alone, I'll be bound he will let us alone. and the smile of exultation as he concluded his remarks showed that his heart was relieved of a very heavy load. Hardly had the remarks of Mr. Hammond escaped his lips when a movement occurred on board the schooner which falsified his predictions. That vessel suddenly changed her course, jibed ship, hauled her wind to the northward, and steered directly for the brig. If any doubts had existed in the mind of MacGregor before, respecting the piratical character of the stranger, they were now dispelled. "It is a pirate," said he, in a low but distinct tone. "It is indeed," responded Mr. Calderon. "My poor Margaret, what will become of her?" "Don't be unnecessarily alarmed," explained the captain. "We may yet succeed in giving her the slip, under cover of the night. What man can do shall be done. At all events, if we cannot escape, we can fight, and it is better to die with arms in our hands than to surrender without a blow, and be afterwards slaughtered like sheep in the shambles, or strung up like dogs in the yardarm." And now MacGregor proved that he possessed energy and resolution meet for the occasion. He ordered the brig to be kept off the wind some 2 or 3 points. The yards were braced in, so that every sail would draw and the main and top foremast and top gallant studding sails were set. The flying jib, royals and staysails of every kind were hoisted, and a careful man was placed at the helm. Whips were prepared for hoisting water aloft, and the sails from the jack-cross trees down were kept saturated with salt water. The good vessel seemed to respond to the wishes of her commander, and like a gallant steed strained every nerve to distance her pursuer. But the breeze seemed to die away as the sun approached the horizon, and the Priam's crew were compelled to admit, though reluctantly, the unwelcome fact that the schooner sailed 3 feet to their 2. Captain MacGregor, finding that escape was hopeless, lost no time in making preparations for embracing the only alternative remaining. There were some half-dozen muskets on board, and a few cutlasses and boarding pikes. The muskets were loaded with buckshot, and arrangements were entered into for making a desperate resistance. Captain MacGregor harangued his men. He told us what was true enough, that it was better to die like brave men, with arms in our hands, nobly fighting for our lives, than to submit like cowards, and afterwards be massacred in cold blood. He reminded us also that there was a woman on board whose honor as well as life was at stake, and that no true Yankee sailor was ever known to desert a woman in distress or to hesitate to sacrifice his life for her protection. He was replied to by 3 cheers such as sailors only know how to give, and we, one and all, pledged ourselves to stand by him so long as we were able to handle a musket or wield a cutlass or a handspike. Mr. Calderon joined the captain in thanking us for our devotion. He was a man of courage and spirit, notwithstanding he was not much of a sailor, and it was plain that his only fear was for the fate of his daughter. There was only one person on board who did not participate in the general enthusiasm, and that was Mr. Hammond, the mate. In a moody, discontented tone, he addressed himself to the captain and asked him if, with only 8 men beside the cook, all told, and no large guns, he thought of resisting the pirates. MacGregor's face grew as dark as night, and a frown gathered upon his brow, but apparently, with a strong effort, he controlled his feelings and nodded in the affirmative. But when Hammond remonstrated, in a mutinous spirit, against such a desperate course, suggesting that life was dear to him, at least, and he had no idea of sacrificing it for any woman that ever lived, and that the only way of saving our lives was to heave the brig to at once and make no show of resistance, the patience of the manly MacGregor was overcome. With one blow of his clenched fist, he stretched the craven-hearted wretch upon the deck, and, as his faithless officer attempted to rise, he was greeted with derisive shouts of laughter from the noble tars, and the stern tones of MacGregor's voice as he said, "You despicable scoundrel, if you wish to save your worthless life, obey my orders to the letter, and do your duty like a man. If I see you flinch from those cutthroats, beg for quarter, or exhibit the slightest sign of fear, for the safety of your own miserable carcass. During the coming fight, I will shoot you through the head with as little remorse as I would the leader of the band of pirates." Margaret had gone below as soon as the true character of the schooner had been ascertained, overcome with fear, as Mr. McGregor and her father supposed, at the prospect of the peril which was impending. But she soon appeared again on deck, with a slight change in her costume, approaching to the Amazonian. Her dress was somewhat abridged and looped up on one side, so as to offer no impediment to the free exercise of her limbs. Her hair, which usually fell in luxuriant ringlets about her swan-like neck, was now gathered and concealed from view beneath an embroidered velvet cap belonging to her father. She wore a dagger at her girdle, and the compression of her lip and the fire which sparkled in her dark eye proclaimed her determination to share the dangers of the approaching strife, and to mingle in the combat which must decide her destiny, and die rather than fall alive into the hands of pirates. Her appearance on deck excited the surprise of her father and the admiration of McGregor. Our hardy tars regarded her with feelings of mingled delight and respect. They venerated her as a being of a superior order, and Whistling Jack, giving Hammond a savage look, said that the man who would talk of surrendering to pirates while such an angelic spirit was on board deserved to be keel-hauled first and afterwards hanged. In the meantime, the wind had in a great measure died away, yet the schooner, impelled by sweeps as well as the gentle breeze, was rapidly coming up. As the sun was sinking beneath the horizon, the pirate vessel was not more than a couple of miles off. A blood-red flag was waving at her peak, and her decks were actually covered with men. A gleam of satisfaction shot across the countenance of Captain McGregor as, after a careful examination through his glass, he announced the fact that there was no large gun on the deck of the schooner. "The rascals," said he, "mean to run alongside and carry us by boarding. We will keep quiet until they are huddled together for the rush upon the decks. Then give them a well-directed volley from our small arms, seize our cutlasses and boarding pikes, and show how bravely true-hearted men can fight when they fight for their lives." At this moment, Whistling Jack approached the captain, and in a whisper suggested something which seemed to meet his hearty countenance. At the end of their conference, he seized the worthy tar by the hand, shook it heartily, and exclaimed aloud, "The idea is a good one, Jack. Their experiment shall be tried, and my good fellow, if we escape from the peril which threatens us, and I feel confident we shall, while Alexander McGregor lives, you shall never want a friend." "Muster this way, my lads," continued the captain, addressing the crew. "Get tackles aloft, clear out the longboat, and get all ready for hoisting it over the side." The men caught the idea and went to work with wonderful alacrity. It seemed but a few minutes before the tackles were rove and hooked on, the lashings were cut, some small spars and sails, some breakers of water, and a quantity of provisions, a miscellaneous collection, were deposited in the boat, which was soon in a condition to be placed in the water over the larboard gunwale at a moment's warning. "If the wind dies away," said the captain to Mr. Calderon and Margaret, "we will take to the boat as soon as it is dark, or as soon as we can place the broadside of the brig between the boat and the pirates to protect us from the shower of bullets which they will otherwise send among us. Twilight in those latitudes is short, yet the schooner approached so rapidly that ere the brig was enveloped in darkness, the dip of the pirate's sweep could be distinctly heard." "Now," said McGregor, in the low but firm and determined tone, "hard down your helm, my lad." The brig, which was proceeding at the rate of some 3 or 4 knots, came to the wind at once. Her sails were taken aback, and she lay motionless as a log on the ocean. "Lower away the boat," said McGregor. The longboat, which had for some time been suspended over the lee gunwale, was floating in the water almost before the words were out of his mouth. "One volley before we go," shouted McGregor, as he seized a loaded musket. "Let us leave some remembrances behind us." And his example was followed by the crew. The schooner was now within pistol shot directly on our starboard beam, heading towards us, and her forecastle and jib boom were full of men ready to board, as soon as she struck our side and cut down every man upon our decks. They little expected the storm of bullets and buckshot which now fell among them, and which, from the fearful shrieks and yelling which followed, must have done terrible execution. But there was now no time to be lost. Into the boat, every man! In for your lives! And as MacGregor spoke, he handed the slight form of Margaret into the hands of her father. At this moment, a volley of musket balls, sent by the pirates, rattled among the rigging. But no one was injured, except the unlucky Hammond, who was shot through the body as he was passing over the gunwale and fell alongside. "Are we all in?" cried the captain as he leaped from the gangway into the stern seats. "If so, shove off. Take your oars, men, and pull for your lives." The boat was hardly a couple of oars' lengths from the brig ere the pirate struck the brig amidships, and, amid a din of arms, horrid oaths, and execrations, a swarm of pirates sprang on board and took possession of the deck. At this critical moment, MacGregor saw that another of our crew besides Hammond was missing. "Where's Whistling Jack?" he exclaimed. "Captain," replied the cook, the stalwart negro who was already doing faithful duty at the oar, "I don't know where he is now, but just before we shot them rascals, he asked me whereabouts in the run the gunpowder was stowed, and then took a pistol and went down the companionway." "Poor fellow, I understand it all now, faithful to the last. Give way, my good men, if you would see the light of another day." "Poor Jack," exclaimed Margaret, whose kind feelings, even in this extremity, urged her to think of others. "Can nothing be done to save him?" But MacGregor, thrusting the tiller into the hands of Mr. Calderon, seized the aft oar, aiding with his powerful arm to force the boat through the water, and exclaimed with frantic energy, "Give way, men! A few more strokes of the oar! Give way for your lives!" At this moment, the pirates, having discovered the escape of the crew, uttered a shout of rage and disappointment, and commenced firing upon the boat, which could be dimly seen a dark object amid the surrounding darkness. A few bullets whistled over the heads of the fugitives, when suddenly the whole ocean around and the heavens above seemed lighted up with unearthly fires. At the same instant, a terrific explosion took place, which seemed to shake the waters beneath and the atmosphere around, producing upon the senses a stunning and appalling effect, which was followed by a strange splashing in the water in every direction, caused by a shower of fragments of planks and timbers and human bodies, which seemed to come down from the clouds. This was succeeded by darkness and a stillness of death. Whistling Jack, as soon as the brig was in possession of the pirates, had flashed a pistol among the gunpowder kegs in the run and blown both vessels into 10,000 fragments. The sea around was covered with the portions of the wreck. Some pieces of plank fell into the boat, but without causing serious injury to anyone on board. Of all that band of ferocious pirates who, a moment before, trod the decks of those vessels, instigated by the most demoniacal passions and breathing curses, hatred, and vengeance, in their disappointment of imbruing their hands in the blood of their unoffending fellow men, not one was left. All were cut off in the midst of their horrible iniquities. The rest of the story is soon told. Little was said among us that night, but shipmates, there was not a man in that boat who did not, in his inmost soul, feel devoutly grateful to a kind providence for our deliverance from the power of the pirates. Sailors say but little about these things and are undoubtedly sinful in many ways, but, you know, in the hour of danger, they feel a deep reliance on the protecting hand of God. When, on the following morning, daylight beamed in the east, many an anxious glance was directed abroad in the hope of discovering some friendly vessel to rescue us from our perilous position, and the first rays of the sun were reflected from the white sails of a large American ship, which under the influence of a favorable breeze was moving rapidly toward us. A signal was made from the boat. We were seen. The ship was hove to, and in a few minutes we were alongside of the ship Daffodil, of Boston, bound to New Orleans. We were received with a true sailor's welcome, and Margaret Calderon was treated with all the tenderness and respect which was due to her forlorn condition and her sex. Here, Ichabod unexpectedly brought his narrative to a close. But his grumbling audience did not seem to be fully satisfied. What became of Margaret? Demanded Ned Allinson. Yes, and what became of McGregor? Muttered old Simon Singleton. Why, replied Ichabod, they were spliced together, of course, soon after they reached New Orleans. The last time I saw them was in the neighborhood of Boston. McGregor, with a countenance as happy as that of a favored lover, was standing in a flower garden in front of a neat little cottage, gathering flowers which he was throwing into the lap of Margaret, who stood by, her features illumined by the smile of happiness, while two chubby little McGregors were gambling and frolicking on the gravel walk. Just then the loud and sonorous whistle was heard by the boat's crew in their immediate neighborhood. "There's Whistling Jack himself," exclaimed Ned Allinson. "Not so good a man," quietly remarked Ichabod. "It's only the captain." "Aye, aye, sir, here we are at the end of the wharf." "Oh, you are there, are you, you sleepy scoundrels? I should have thought it rained hard enough to keep you awake," said the captain in a hoarse, surly, and somewhat inarticulate voice. "Well, haul to the stern of the boat and spread the boat cloak. That's it. Shove off and give way. Let's get on board before 'tis broad daylight, and before I get thoroughly soaked outside as well as in. Give way, I say." "Aye, aye, sir," was the obedient response of the boat's crew. So that wraps up two episodes of Whistling Jack. Fascinating it is, even to this day, sailors still are a superstitious bunch. And I don't know, perhaps whistling on board a ship is bad luck, but in this case, it's mixed. In the first half, we had the story with the storm after Whistling Jack began whistling, and then in the second half here, Whistling Jack redeems himself by blowing up the magazine and allowing the rest of the crew and the passengers to escape. But nevertheless, either way, a wonderful sea story. And as always, look me up on the social networks, follow me, message me, like and subscribe. I'd greatly appreciate it. The last few episodes, I have been requesting just a special favor. Please go on the iBooks app or onto Amazon and find the short story. It's called 64 Days. It's the story of a Navy senior chief petty officer who is charged with the management of a disaster. I won't give away any spoilers, but I would greatly appreciate it. It won't take you but 35, 40 minutes to read this story and post a review, please, on iBooks, on Amazon. Please find that story, 64 Days, by myself, Malcolm Torres, and post a review. I've got several more episodes in the works and expecting to put out two more a week for at least the next couple months. So looking forward to the rest of these stories and meeting you all online. Until then, fair winds and following seas, shipmates.